Welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 40 for March 10th, 2010. My name is Ben Snitkoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rebbe
and David O'Brien.
We've got our usual three stories for you this week. First off, we've got the Fifth Circuit taking innocent infringement off of the table in RIAA copyright suit cases. Second, we've got Apple suing HTC over iPhone-related patents. And third, whether or not poaching Lady Gaga tickets could land you in the clink. First of all, we're going to deal with this RIAA story. So this is yet another in the long line of cases that have come out regarding the RIAA's suit against music consumers. This one follows the typical set of facts. A woman in Texas downloaded some files off of Media Sentry, off of some file sharing application, Media Sentry. The RIAA's private electronic sleuths went on this file sharing place, browsed this woman's shared folder, and found, I think it was either 31 or 37 music files in there, downloaded them to make sure that they were legitimate music files, and then they filed suit against her. Now, she claimed that she was an innocent infringer, that she didn't realize that what she was doing constituted copyright infringement, that she thought it was akin to streaming something off of the internet, which is totally legal. Now, the judge below in the district court, the trial court, agreed with her and said that, you know, we're going to send this question to the jury, and the jury will be able to decide whether or not whether or not this was innocent infringement, whether or not she didn't realize she was infringing copyright. The recording industry appealed from that ruling, and the Fifth Circuit agreed with them, saying that there was a statutory bar that prevented this woman from claiming innocent infringement. Now, David, could you go over a little bit what that statutory bar is?
Well, first we should probably back up before the statutory bar and talk a little bit about innocent infringement. And there is a section under the Copyright Act, under 17 U.S.C. and then section 504(c)(2), and that's sort of the basis for this innocent infringer provision. It's not necessarily something new. I mean, this has been in the code for some time, probably since the 1976 Copyright Act revision, I think, unless one of you guys wants to correct me. And anyway, I'm going to read right out of the statute here just so we get the basis of what this is all about. This particular section has a couple sentences to it, but there's only one that matters to us. And it says, in a case where the infringer sustains the burden of proving and the court finds that such infringer was not aware and had no reason to believe that his or her acts constitute an infringement of copyright, the court, in its discretion, may reduce the award of statutory damages to a sum of not less than $200. So this was the particular provision that the defendant in the case invoked, and what she was essentially saying, and this is, by the way, we should talk about the defendant herself, she was actually a high school student at the time. These acts of infringement dated back to, I think, 2004, and she basically said, you know, I was a little bit naive. I didn't think that what I was doing was wrong. I think the very particular phrase that they use is that she didn't think it was any different than listening to a radio station when she was downloading those files. And as we mentioned, the district court interpreted this provision to mean to be able to present a question to the jury to find whether or not she was in fact an innocent infringer, and they did in this case. Now, there is another section under the Copyright Act, which I believe is section 402D, which actually gives us a limitation on this section 504C innocent infringer provision. And that is where if a copyright owner has a notice that appears on, for instance, published phonographs or sound recordings, then no weight shall be given to the innocent infringer defense, if there should be one in a case. And the argument that the plaintiffs made here was that, well, these were sound recordings. On all of our sound recordings, meaning our CDs and any of the official ones that were sold as digital downloads, there are notices of copyright infringement, and the defendant in this case should have had some reason to know that these were, in fact, registered copyright. The sound recordings did have registered copyrights that attached to them. And the court, in the end, agreed with the plaintiff's assertion that this 402D limitation should apply in this case. And so then they said that there's no way that she could have taken advantage of the innocent infringer provision.
Right, and I think we can all agree that in this case, the copyright notices were published on these CD-ROMs, and that CD music CDs, not CD-ROMs, and that those were, at the very least, in record stores. I think what the defendant here was challenging was saying that, well, first of all, yes, they were on CDs, but the copyright notices weren't on the electronic copies, and secondly, they have to prove that I had access to these things, that I would have had an opportunity to go in and look at them. And the court seems to give short shrift to the question of knowledge access here. There's not a whole, I mean, it just seems like they're available for her to have found. It doesn't require that she actually ever saw these, that she ever purchased or even went into a record store where she would have seen those copyright notices.
This is really interesting because I think we all know that in most circumstances under the law, ignorance is no exception to having to follow the law, positive law that's out there. And I would have really suspected in a case like this where you have a young individual, I don't know how old she was at the time, but I'm going to guess since she was a high school student, she was obviously in her teenage years. Not every teenager, I would suspect, is terribly familiar with the Copyright Act and it could be the case that norms had just been at the time that, people at high school weren't really aware that this is something that was necessarily illegal. And the whole basis for that Section 402D limitation, the court seemed to interpret this like very broadly, just because that there are that just because that the copyright owner himself has published photo records out there that are available that do in fact have the notice on them that this is a copyrighted work and perhaps all rights are reserved or whatever language they might have included, just because those are out there in stores or maybe you could view that online or there was some way that she could have figured out that these were in fact copyrighted works, that therefore she had some sort of notice or reason to have some sort of notice, and that's why she shouldn't be able to take advantage of the innocent infringer situation.
Right, the languages has access to, but you gotta wonder where that line gets drawn. I mean, the requirements are copyright notice on the published thing, so there has to be some sort of publication. But if I, let's say I sit down and I make a CD, put a copyright notice, and I sell it at Newbery Comics in Boston. Let's say the only place it is Newbery Comics on Newbery Street in Boston, Massachusetts. And somebody downloads it illegally in California. Do they have? Will 402D bar them from bringing the innocent infringer defense?
My guess is that in that particular situation, that might be a little bit too broad of a reading of the same of what the court is interpreting here, since we were presumably talking about nationally distributed records. We weren't talking about something that was just tied to a local area. So that might be the differentiating fact in a case like you're suggesting, where it's only sold at one store on one street in Boston. I mean, in that case, it shouldn't seem that a person would be presumed to have access to a notice registration that might appear on one of those works as opposed to something that's sold on the national level.
So she actually was arguing that she was just really, really naive, and thought she was listening to a internet radio station. And the 402D access question, she was like, "Well, I haven't seen the records and the record stores, and further, I was naive."
Yeah, naivete plays deep into her defense here, but
It's not going to help her.
no, it's
But
not.
she's
Not at
still,
all.
but the funny thing is she's still admitting that, yeah, I did download these songs, but I shouldn't have to pay the full range of statutory damages, and which we've seen in other trials is substantial. I mean, we got a $1.92 million verdict in the Jamie Thomas case, although that was reduced the other week, and we've covered that. And we saw the Joel Tenenbaum case, where the ultimate award was $675,000. So, I mean, this could be one way that younger individuals, especially those in high school, which when I was in high school, I cannot say that I was any bit familiar with the Copyright Act and what the exclusive rights were under the Copyright Act. And it could have been the case if I was in that position, which I never was, by the way, because people weren't really doing a whole lot of file sharing back then. I couldn't say that I was in a position to really understand what I was doing was breaking the law.
Well, couldn't she have argued that she presumed that the file she was downloading from the internet radio station, quote-unquote, that she was accessing through LimeWire, those people, she presumed they had the rights to distribute them, because otherwise they wouldn't be distributing them?
That still doesn't defeat the fact that 402D is a total bar to her infringement. Is a total bar to, rather, the innocent infringement defense. It doesn't matter what she was... So, for the question of infringement, it doesn't matter what she was thinking if 402D comes into play. It does matter with regard to damages, though, whether or not they were willful. And, I mean, depending on how she plays it out on the stand, if this actually does go to trial, at least on the damages portion, she may have a decent argument that the infringement wasn't willful infringement of copyright.
I see the mistake in her defense. Basically, she didn't contest access to the CDs that would have informed her that the material was copyrighted. Instead, she argued, I'm young and naive. She should have contested access and said, well, I've never been in a record store in my life because I didn't have money as a teenager, so I just download these songs from this cool internet radio station I found.
Right, but the point I was trying to make with David was that I don't think that denying that you've ever been into a record store would necessarily defeat that. That part of the 402D bar, because she still had access to them. The question isn't whether or not she had actual notice, it's whether or not she had access to the phono records or the CDs. And I think she did.
When would this access requirement actually apply?
I mean, it would apply in the absurd hypothetical that I came up with, when the thing isn't either one isn't published, where guess it isn't
country.
Published. Yeah, well, that is published, but it's published in a narrow area that would prevent access. So it's not published with a copyright notice, or published where you don't have any type of reasonable or possible access to the actual physical device or unit, media.
Right, and you know what? I really don't disagree with that at all. I think that's the proper reading that you should give in this case. But that said, if you have a work that's published and only available in one store nationally, and let's say it's Boston like you suggested, but you live in Texas or California, and you're 16 years old or 15 years old, can we really presume that you have some sort of hypothetical access point there? I don't think so, unless, you know, there's other facts that might support that. Yeah, maybe you spend all your summers in Boston, or maybe you're a world traveler and you have a lot of money, even though you're only 15 or 16 years old. It would seem that in those circumstances, facts like we have a young defendant who's still in high school who might not have access in those circumstances. I don't know that 402D might apply, but you would probably see a situation where both parties would be arguing those facts very diligently, and it would come down to a determination before the court of whether or not there was access.
Yeah, upon looking at this opinion a little more closely, I think the reason why the Court of Appeals here didn't look very closely at the access issue was because the judge below found that the defendant did have access, but said, you know, despite the fact that she had access, I'm taking her naivete into account. That being said, the proper standard of review for a summary judgment like this is de novo, so they probably should have addressed it, but it makes some sense that they didn't go very deep into the access issue here, because, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it was hotly contested, as we alluded to before. Any last thoughts on this, David?
No, not really. I mean, there were some other interesting arguments that we don't really have time to cover here in the case, but she did try to assert a due process argument that the statutory damages were grossly disproportionate to the amount of harm that she actually caused by downloading these songs. And the court didn't even really speak anything on those merits because of a procedural error that they made. Basically, when you're in a district court, you have to preserve certain arguments if you're planning to appeal them, and that really just means that you need to raise them before the trial court, and the trial court either has to deny it or rule on it on one particular way before you can raise it on appeal after you have a verdict or you have some sort of disposition on a motion. And she tried, well, it seems like her counsel might have attempted to raise it, but didn't perfectly articulate his argument, so it wasn't preserved then for appeal. And so the Fifth Circuit didn't hear that argument, or they mentioned it in the case that she brought it up, but they were unwilling to address it on the merits.
Dominic, any last thoughts on your part?
I'll sit here.
Okay, so our next big story is Apple suing HTC over some patents. I believe there are 10 patents at issue in the case here, and they range from everything for relating to object-oriented programming, scaling down the power to a CPU to conserve battery life, to using gestures to unlock a device. I think I'm going to throw this one open a little earlier because the background is simply Apple sues HTC. Dominic, I'll throw this one to you first. What are your initial thoughts on this suit?
Well, it's very much unlike Apple to go around suing people for patents. Usually they only bust out their patents when someone sues them.
Yeah, it's a bit unusual. So the last big patent suit involving Apple that we saw was Nokia suing Apple over some patents, and then Apple filed countersuit. And one interesting kind of procedural note, in both of those cases, complaints were filed with the International Trade Commission in addition to in a federal district court. So in both of those, in the Nokia case, first of all, the district court proceeding has been stayed pending resolution in the International Trade Commission, and Apple filed a complaint in district court. I believe it was in Delaware. I want to say it's in Delaware against HTC,
yes.
and then they also filed something with the International Trade Commission. So if everything goes according to the way that it typically does, what'll happen is the International Trade Commission proceedings will start, and then Apple. The suit in federal district court will be stayed pending resolution of the International Trade Commission.
Right. So actually, I've read that it's closer to 20 patents, not just 10 patents, and it seems that there might be some difference in patents that are brought up in the ITC complaint versus the district court complaint in Delaware. I've yet to have the time to sit down and actually compare the patent numbers that they raised in both of those cases and see if that's actually the case. But that seems to be what some of the tech media outlets are reporting at present.
The other interesting thing about this story is the quote by Steve Jobs. He's like, "We can sit by and watch competitors steal our patented inventions, or we can do something about it. We've decided to do something about it. We think competition is healthy, but competitors should create their own original technology, not steal ours." And I guess what I want to point to is his use of the word steal. Patent law is such that it doesn't really matter whether they stole your technology or copied your technology, as long as it infringes on what you have patented. It's very possible HTC didn't copy or steal Apple's technology, but just happened to invent the same technology after Apple had obtained its patents, which meant that HTC couldn't use that without a license from Apple. But it seems like there's a misconception, which Steve is perpetuating here, that infringement requires some theft or copying, and that's just not true.
Well, not just that, but didn't Steve Jobs classically say not too long ago, perhaps a few years ago, that some of the best technology has been stolen between companies, and that has become the basis of how to create premium products?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty famous that Apple, in their earlier days, flew a pirate flag above their campus, and they pretty much stole the idea of the graphical user interface from Xerox PARC, which was their advanced research division back in the day. I mean, on the flip side of that, Xerox, nobody at Xerox, except for the people who invented the graphical user interface, really thought that it was a good idea. As a result, they didn't really go forward with it. Yeah, one of the many oversights in the history of the tech world.
So the next thing that's really fascinating about this case to me is that they're suing HTC, which is the developer of the handheld device, or several handheld devices that are at issue. But they didn't include Google or Microsoft in the litigation, and these patents concern both hardware aspects and some are related to just software aspects. And we know that a lot of the HTC devices both run the Microsoft mobile software, or the mobile's Windows software, and they also run the Google Android software.
Yeah, right. I thought that was kind of interesting. There have been murmurs of what was going on between Apple and Google. For the longest time, Google, despite having a capacitive touchscreen on their on most, if not all, of the Android devices, didn't enable multi-touch on the Google-branded applications like Google Maps and particularly Google Maps. They've since enabled that, and many people thought that Google declined to enable it because they had a gentleman's agreement with Apple that they they wouldn't make a foray into, you know, the Apple multi-touch area. But I agree, it is strange that, especially, you know, both the iPhone and the Nexus One use gestures to unlock the devices, or can use gestures to unlock the devices. And the Nexus One, I meant Android. And it seems strange to sue HTC, but not sue Google, who made the software that HTC is installing.
My theory is, at least, that Google and Microsoft are sort of the 800-pound gorillas in the room these days in terms of what they have in cash in the bank, and those two companies might be the most willing to defend their technology in patent litigation. Whereas I don't know any of the particulars about HTC's financials, but I would suspect that they're probably a smaller company than Google and or Microsoft. So maybe by suing HTC directly, they're trying to strong-arm HTC, at least at first. It doesn't mean, of course, that Google and Microsoft can't join the litigation later as interested parties to the litigation. But at the same time, it might seem like they're trying to strong-arm HTC into getting into either some sort of settlement agreement at first, or sort of just stirring up the waters a bit.
HTC has about just under $4 billion worth of revenue at the last figure that we have available in 2007, and Apple was about $40 billion at the time, so they're about one-tenth the size. But it's possible that Microsoft and Google, especially Google, if it licensed the software that's in question to HTC, might be forced to join because of an indemnity clause in the license agreement. So they might be fighting Apple in court because they're required to by the terms of their license agreement.
That's
especially
with
if it
regard
their
to
software.
With regard to cash on hand, I just did some quick research. It seems like Apple and Microsoft are tied at about $40 billion cash on hand. Google's got $22 billion cash on hand. And this was as of about February. Intel's down to 19 billion cash on hand. But yeah, as far as who's willing to throw money at this, I think everybody involved is willing to throw money at it. Dominic, was that HTC number, was that revenue last quarter, or was that cash on hand?
That was revenue in fiscal year 2007, which is the most up-to-date figure I could find. And the Apple number was actually fiscal year 2009 revenue, which is apples to apples, and some isn't apples to apples comparison. So
the other thing about this too is that some of these patents are pretty old. I mean, they date back more than 10 years ago to the late 90s. We're not really talking about some of the more sexy features of the iPhone that are really being litigated here. They seem to be a little bit more of the mundane aspects of how some of the baseline communication, either the software and the hardware, interact on a phone. And you know, it must be, of course, that Apple, when they have, as they have these things, that all those features are being used probably on the iPhone. But at the same time, it's not like we're seeing litigation that has to do with the pinch to zoom feature that the iPhone famously has, or any of those other sort of cool aspects of gestures, aside from that slide to unlock feature that the iPhone has, and also some of the Android phones have. Do you guys think that this is more about Android and Google than it is the Microsoft devices, or does this seem to run the gamut and be about both of them?
I mean, it's an effective way to make a move against Android without suing Google, because if, say, Apple, you know, brings this lawsuit to trial and wins the lawsuit against HTC for the, you know, specifically with regard to the Android devices, then, I mean, who's going to sell Android devices anymore? You know, there are a lot of manufacturers who are making them, but if, you know, there's the threat of, you know, an Apple suit, you know, Apple bringing a lawsuit and having a good chance to win it against you, people are going to drop Android like it's hot. That being said, I don't understand why Apple's bringing this suit. They have a rather dominant position, and they keep on, you know, adding new features to their phones and to their software that makes it continually compelling. I mean, I will say, the competitors are catching up faster than they have in the past, but it just doesn't strike me that this is a necessary step for Apple.
It's just another way to foreclose competition, I think. And since Apple does, in fact, have patents on these things, and since some of them are so old, I mean, there's a stronger argument that some of them are definitely not invalid or shouldn't be or couldn't be easily invalidated. And you know, you can't really blame Apple for protecting its position in the marketplace, no matter how good it might seem or how concerned they might be about what's coming out down the line. So it doesn't surprise me that they are in fact suing on it despite their dominant market position.
One thing that broke very recently, so I don't expect my panelists to have a firm grasp of this story, and indeed I'm just running off of a couple of articles that I read. Apple and a couple of, well, allegedly Apple, the evidence that Apple was involved in this is kind of slim, but some tech companies coordinated with the German police and raided and shut down a couple of booths at CeBIT for... because those companies were allegedly had products that violated European patents that the companies held. And I found that interesting. I had never heard of that happening at a trade show before. And furthermore, I think they'd have a tough time doing that in the United States. It would be difficult to, you know, have somebody come into the United States, bring these infringing devices, and get a preliminary injunction or even a temporary restraining order, you know, on just that quick to even shut down a booth at a trade show. It's a very unusual move, and like I said, it's unclear if Apple's involved. The one report I said one person who was allegedly an Apple lawyer was seen discussing with other lawyers. So it's unclear if Apple was directly involved with this, but it was a move I had never seen before. Had any of you guys seen anything like that?
No, not necessarily, but I'm not terribly familiar with German law. Is that where this took place at CeBIT?
Right. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, so I don't know what the standards are in Germany for obtaining preliminary injunctions or other types of injunctive relief which would otherwise bar a company from presenting technology at a conference before it's released or as it's being released or whatever.
Okay, it looks like we're just about our time to be moving on. Dominic, do you have any last thoughts?
All set here.
David?
No, not in particular, but... surely this is an interesting case, and we'll just have to see where it goes, what happens with Google and Microsoft. I mean, this is huge because it involves so many different patents and popular devices as well, you know, when you consider the Nexus One and the Droid phone, and those seem to be gaining market share by the day as I see more and more of those out and about here in Boston. So I guess we'll keep our eyes on it, and we'll see if this ends up being 5 or 10 year litigation about these two things that... ends up resulting in either one of the companies involved in it shutting down their phones or getting around it or trying to get around the patents or, you know, or features get removed or if there's some sort of licensing agreement that comes out of this.
Yep. So our last story is there's a company that was just run by a handful of friends, and they developed some software that would go on the internet when a tickets for a sporting event or a concert went on sale. And they'd use, I guess, is several computers to go on and buy as many tickets as possible before people could go in and, you know, buy their tickets themselves. Not exactly a savory business, but... I think everyone was a little surprised when they were indicted on 40-some-odd counts of things ranging from fraud to hacking. Now, here, Dominic, why don't you take this? From what we could garner, you know, what was the basis of this hacking charge?
Basically, they're circumventing CAPTCHA, as far as I can tell. CAPTCHA is the little funny-looking characters that people put on websites to try to make sure that humans are the ones... entering information so that bots can't spam register.
Right. The only other thing I could think of is that they were taking kind of the Laurie Drew tact and saying that, you know, somewhere in the terms of a service of these sites, you have to affirm that you're not a bot or that you're buying them for your own use. But the Laurie Drew theory of prosecution that by violating the terms of service, you're getting unauthorized access or exceeding authorized access to the site, that's dicey. I mean, that's very dicey. The district court judge in the Laurie Drew case threw out the charges, and then the government didn't appeal. So, you know, who knows if that would ever hold up in court again. And, yeah.
Well, you have to admit that these are pretty precarious facts. I can remember back to college that when I had some friends that would be interested in a concert that would be coming to town, and they'd be like, okay, let's get tickets, and, you know, me and a bunch of my friends would agree, and so our friend who was buying tickets for all of us would try to get on, and as soon as the tickets went on sale, the tickets would sell out in 5 to 10 minutes, and that was it, and you couldn't get any more tickets unless you went on to eBay or one of the other online authorized ticket distributors aside from Ticketmaster or whoever was selling them. And in this case, what you really have is these guys created some software, or they were using some software that was able to access the website and obtain tickets faster than humans were. And after obtaining those tickets, it was a substantial amount of tickets, they would obtain the best seats in the house, basically. They would go and resell them then to other ticket brokers for additional fees, more than you would have received them if you went through Ticketmaster or whoever was selling them. And so they made a lot of money doing this. I mean, I think some of the statistics I read, we were talking over $50 million and 1.5 million tickets, which were really at issue. And they were gaming some of the largest events, including the New York Yankees, who were in the World Series this year, including some of the major headlining events. Lady Gaga, who is extremely popular, I'm told, these days, was definitely one of them, and that's what some of the Wall Street, at least the Wall Street Journal article, focused on her. And so people were not able to get tickets, but they were being forced to go to other places and pay premiums based on the face value of those tickets. And that really strikes me as inherently unfair, but you have a serious legal problem here. And if you're going to go by that terms of service argument, which you might be able to, although it seems a little bit tenuous, you're talking about contract rights that would really go between a company like Ticketmaster and the individual who's going on to actually buy the tickets, or in this case, the bot or the computer software which is attempting to buy them. And so those are more about private rights than they are about public rights. And the FBI was involved in this. I think the FBI was the one who actually did, if there was any raids, that took any of the hardware that they had. And then there were criminal indictments. So we're not talking about litigating civil rights. We're talking about actual criminal indictments, which don't typically involve private contracts in that manner. I mean, it could be the fact that Ticketmaster and some of the other companies involved, and actually I don't know, you guys can correct me if there was other companies involved, if they were involved with the FBI during the course of these investigations and in determining how people were obtaining a mass amount of tickets, and if then that's sort of the basis for some right of a or some sort of interest in a criminal action apart from the civil aspects of contract law that might apply to a terms of service agreement on a website.
I'm going to read a couple of sentences from the Wall Street Journal article right now. Quote, the indictment charged that the men obtained the tickets in a fraudulent manner, circumventing corporate rules limiting the number of tickets that any one person could buy. That, prosecutor said, amounted to stealing property rights, unquote. I get how the first part, that kind of nestles into our discussion about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Lori Drew case. Stealing property rights?
Yeah,
anybody have any idea?
That.
Yeah. Well, see, it's funny, though, because, I mean, there just doesn't really seem to be any right to buy a ticket, but I guess you could, and in some sense, Ticketmaster isn't really losing any money, because the tickets are still being purchased at face value as they're being offered. It's more about usurping the fact that there might be some other market beyond that primary market of selling directly, whereby someone's making money, you know, additional money by selling to brokers, but as far as I know, as long as those brokers are authorized and it's permissible under state law, it doesn't really seem like you have too much to stand on there in terms of actual property rights, which might have been violated. But then again, though, I mean, Ticketmaster does seem to have policies on their website, which in the terms of service agreement, which states that, you know, you need to be buying these for individual use or personal use. You're not buying them to go out and rebroker them. So, and the other part of this is it seems to be that the FBI thinks that they're impersonating individuals when they're doing this, and so there is some element of fraud that might be involved in obtaining the tickets because they're not individuals, they're not using them for personal use, they're, you know, only getting them for the purpose of reselling them and making more money.
I don't think that rises to electronic fraud, though.
Well, you're lying about who you are, though. You're impersonating.
No, they're not lying about who they are. They're using people's credit cards with their permission to purchase these tickets. So they're not lying about who they are. They're purchasing on behalf of other people.
But if the terms of service agreement is forcing you to warrant that you're buying these for personal use, you're clearly not in that instance, and so you are, in some way, being a bit
right,
fraudulent
but under those,
about how you're purchasing them.
But, I mean, if I asked you to buy me a ticket for the Lady Gaga concert, then would that be fraudulent because you were buying it to give it to me?
I'm not
I think under the prosecutor's... Under the prosecutor's theory, I think that would be fraudulent. You know, even if you were selling it at a premium.
But if I wasn't, though, if he was basically, if I was sort of just buying them for the two of us, and Dominic gives me the face value of the money that the tickets are worth later on or beforehand, and then I give him a ticket, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with that. But when you go, if I gave it to you and then you went and just said, oh, okay, well, I don't really want to go to the concert anymore, but instead I'm going to sell it to this brokerage company for, you know, $25 more than the face value.
Right, but my argument, I guess, is at the point of purchase, those two scenarios are indistinguishable.
Yeah, I agree. I think more to the point, you know, if the Ticketmaster's complaint in I guess even the federal government's complaint is that people shouldn't be buying these tickets to resell them at a higher price. I mean, just look at Ticketmaster and Live Nation, who did essentially that. They reserved certain tickets and diverted them to a secondary reseller to make more money on them. I mean, if this is the problem that we're going after, I think we're going after the wrong people to begin with. We should be... This is, a side rant. You know, if we're really worried about that, we should have done the Department of Justice should have done something about Ticketmaster having this monopoly on ticket sales as opposed to going after people who are, you know, taking advantage of that monopoly secondhand.
I mean, honestly, in Ticketmaster's shoes, I don't understand why they don't just allow people to bid for tickets and the people who bid for the most win. That would maximize their profit.
I don't know. It still strikes me there's something going on here that's not really fair when this company is able to step in and make more money by taking them faster than people can even get them and then reselling them. They're taking all the best seats in the house. And, you know, it could be me, like back in college when we couldn't get tickets to certain events just because as soon as they went open, someone was able to do it faster and smarter than I was able to. And then not only that, they were reselling them and forcing me, if I wanted to go to that concert, to have to pay an additional, you know, amount of money beyond the face value.
Well, I mean, basically there's a market distortion here. Ticketmaster is selling the tickets at a price too low in some sort of attempt to maybe make the attendance of the concerts a greater swath of society can afford to attend the concerts, so perhaps the concerts will be better, but people are going to take advantage of that because, I mean, there's surplus to be taken, and that's exactly what these guys are doing. My question here is, if they hadn't automated this using technology, would they still be liable for fraud? Say they hire 50,000 people to do this immediately when Ticketmaster puts tickets online. Would they still be looking at these charges?
While they might be able to do that, though, we're talking about different profit motivations. Because if you hired 50,000 people to do that, you're probably not making that much money as opposed to here where you're making almost pure profit on what you resell because it's all automated. I mean, I agree.
Right.
I am with you. I think that the law is not necessarily in the favor of the government in this case, but what I'm disagreeing on is I think that what they're doing here is a little bit wrong, and it does seem to be a bit like wire fraud or at least fraudulent.
But, I mean, you seemed unwilling to say that the 50,000 people would be fraud because they wouldn't be making any money doing that. And to me, that doesn't make sense because, again, the act, you have to distinguish the act itself from the consequences of the act. The fact whether or not they're making money doesn't influence whether or not it's fraud.
Okay, you might be right, but is someone really likely to do that, though, to hire the human power in that instance where they're not really going to be making that much money, if any, at all?
No, they wouldn't, but if that isn't fraud, then this isn't fraud either, and similarly, if this is fraud, then that is fraud.
Yeah, and I think, David, you're grossly underestimating how cheap it would be to get, you know, that much human labor to do something for, you know, how long would it take? 10 minutes? And, you know...
10 minutes at
so
the right
paying,
time.
Yeah, 10 minutes at the right time. You could farm that out to any country on the any country in this great world where people have internet access. I think it would be substantially cheaper than you think it would. And considering some of these tickets sold at, you know, profits or markups of over $1,000, I mean, I don't think they would have had any problem clearing even a substantial profit. if they did this with people as opposed to computers.
Well, you might be right. At least in one of the articles that I read, probably in the Wall Street Journal, there was some mention that they were utilizing individuals in Bulgaria and Indonesia to help accomplish this. I don't know what that exactly means, since the rest of the article was talking about automated ticket purchasing, not using individuals. But I guess it might be a little bit different, too, if you were using individuals, because in theory, at least, you couldn't accomplish what you're doing through individuals if you have 50,000 of them. If you contrast that to being able to use some sort of automated software, which, according to the article, is doing it faster and it has more access and it can click through quicker than humans can do it, that might make it a little bit different. But since they're using software and the software is accessing things almost instantaneously and able to go through the interface and purchase those tickets faster than other people can, it just strikes me as different. It feels like they're violating something here, and they're taking profit away from somebody else where they shouldn't be able to. Or if not profit, they're taking away at least the value of those tickets to individuals. And I don't know how Ticketmaster really feels about this, but if I was in Ticketmaster Corporate, it really makes trying to buy tickets for events much less attractive if you cannot get them in the time frame that they're being offered online, and you're forced to go through other brokerage sites. You're diverting the traffic to the website, and you're forcing them to go other places, and people are paying more. So it's kind of hurting the events a little bit, too.
Then maybe the people who are organizing the event shouldn't, you know, have made that deal with Live Nation and Ticketmaster that long ago, and should have used some other ticket broker, or instead multiple ticket brokers.
Well,
but, you know,
great
that's
point,
a...
because maybe that's exactly what's happening. If that's exactly what's happening, you're interfering with business contracts then when you're doing this. And that could be another civil, a basis for a civil action for, you know, contract interference.
Wait, who's interfering with business contracts?
If you take the theory that who's actually getting hurt here, it's the performers or the production companies who are behind the events themselves, because maybe people are less interested in going to the events because they have to pay more because they have to go through these third-party brokerage sites, and they're paying more money than they should at face value, then those guys might be a little bit upset because maybe less people are going to the concerts. I don't know what the statistics are. I certainly don't have them in front of me, but... that would make, if I was one of those producers of one of those events, I might be a little bit upset at Ticketmaster that someone has the ability to go in and use software in this manner, and that might amount to an interference with a business contract.
Mm. I really wonder whether we'll see some sort of law in the future that will make it a crime to circumvent human detection algorithms in some sort of automated fashion.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, what really seems to be the problem here is, oh, at least to me, I know you guys might disagree about a little bit, but it's less about the actions of this company, Wise Guys Incorporated. It's more about the fact that the law doesn't really fit the circumstances terribly well. And it seems to me that what is going on here is at least it's wrong. People shouldn't be able to force ticket prices up like this, completely automated. So. Some like a change in the law where it makes it a violation of, say, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to circumvent a CACPA or a RECACPA or something that is made to deter bots or software from purchasing things or registering at websites. That would probably make this criminal indictment a lot easier than it is at present.
Sure. Yeah, I'm gonna agree with you, David, that it's wrong, but at the moment I don't think it's criminal, and I think the prosecutors are going to have a really tough time proving their case. Dominic, last thoughts? You were going to say something?
Yeah, I agree with you, Ben. Again, I agree that it's ethically wrong, but I don't think it's against the law right now.
David, last thoughts?
I'm a little bit less familiar with the allegations of fraud over or utilizing wire communications for the purposes of fraud, and maybe that plays a little bit more substantially in this case than does, say, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act allegations, which is all about exceeding authorized access to a website. So it could be the case that, you know, that argument is just a little bit stronger in the criminal action, but we'll see as it comes out, and maybe hopefully the indictment will also surface and we can figure out a little bit more about what the government is after here.
Okay, We'd like to thank you all for joining us today for the Technically Legal podcast. We'd like to remind you to please visit our website, www.technicallylegal.org. There you'll find our podcast and our blog. You can email us, podcast@technicallylegal.org, and please do so with any suggestions, recommendations that you have. You can follow us on Twitter, @TechLegal. And that's about all I got. So signing off, I'm Ben Snitko.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm not stealing your concert tickets.
Thanks for joining us.